From NPR News, this is a remembrance of Cokie Roberts. I'm Michelle Martin. A few days after her death at the age of 75, family, colleagues, friends, and members of the public gathered in Washington, D.C. at the Cathedral of St. Matthew the Apostle for a mass for Cokie Roberts to celebrate her life and legacy. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi was among them.
Cokie was raised in a family that believed that public service was a noble calling. Cokie acted upon those values throughout her entire life. She said that she was the only one in her family who did not run for office, and she wanted journalism to be her public service. And indeed, it was. With the knowledge and understanding developed as a daughter of the Congress, she illuminated the workings of Congress in the fairest possible way, with respect for all views for people across America.
This hour, we hear more about Cokie Roberts' pioneering work as a woman in journalism, about her professionalism and insightful reporting, about the many other people she mentored and inspired. First, the basic facts. She was born in New Orleans in 1943 and named Mary Martha Corrine Morrison Claiborne Boggs, a long name that gave way to her nickname.
My brother Tommy was 3 years older than me, and when I came home from the hospital, he couldn't say Corrine. And he christened me Cokie, and I've been Cokie ever since.
She practically grew up in Congress. Her father was Hale Boggs, one of Louisiana's Democratic representatives. He became the House Majority Leader before he died in a plane crash in 1972. Her mother, Lindy Boggs, ran for his seat and held it for nearly two decades. Cokie earned a degree in political science, but after she graduated from Wellesley College in 1964, she had a hard time breaking into the male-dominated world of journalism. As she once recalled to the New York Times, she spent 8 months job hunting at various magazines and television stations, and wherever she went, she was asked how many words per minute she could type, a typical qualification for a secretary, not necessarily a reporter. In an interview with NPR's Fresh Air, Cokie told host Terry Gross there were a lot of jobs she didn't get, even though she was qualified for them.
Were you told point blank that it was because you were a woman?
Point blank. We don't hire women to do that. Their voices lack authority, or we don't hire women writers because men have to work for the writers, and obviously men can't work for women. Every imaginable thing was said of the reasons they couldn't hire you, leave because you'll get pregnant, all of that. And it was all said straight out loud. And in some ways, it's refreshing because there was no pretense. It was exactly what it is, what they said was what they meant.
Cokie Roberts found work as a freelance correspondent for CBS Radio before joining NPR. Here's Nina Totenberg's description of how that came about.
In the late 70s, Steve Roberts, who then worked for the New York Times, her husband, delivered to me her resume, and I then brought it to the head of news at the time, and he hired her on a temporary basis.
That temporary gig turned into a relationship with NPR that lasted more than 40 years, first as a reporter covering politics and other stories, then, after she started reporting and hosting at ABC News, as an analyst and commentator. Cokie excelled at explaining how things worked, or should work, mainly in Congress, but also in the White House and in government and politics broadly defined. She used plain, sharp, and witty language. She had a deep knowledge and love of American history, especially the too often unsung achievements of women. She wrote a number of books, including Founding Mothers, The Women Who Raised Our Nation, Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington, and We Are Our Mother's Daughters. Many of you heard all of this regularly on Morning Edition during a weekly segment called Ask Cokie, where she answered questions like, who held the first White House press conference?
So, Woodrow Wilson is credited with having the first one. I did not cover it, I would like you to know.
But, for the record.
And what is the deal with Senate Rule 19, the one that states,
no senator in debate shall directly or indirectly by any form of words impute to another senator or to other senators any conduct or motive unworthy or unbecoming of the Senate.
Here's Cokie's take when Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell used the rule to silence Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren when she was objecting to the nomination of fellow Senator Jeff Sessions for Attorney General.
Look, as I said, they do criticize one another, usually by talking first by saying, my esteemed colleague. And of course, Senator McConnell himself was called a liar not too long ago by Senator Ted Cruz, and nobody invoked this rule. So what's going on here is politics. But McConnell is learning that he's living in a new world. His statement that Warren had been warned, but, quote, nevertheless she persisted, is now on T-shirts and mugs, and women are signing up for workshops to learn how to run for office all over the country, and they're paying money to do it.
The final Ask Cokie segment about the history of recessions aired on August 29th, just a few weeks before she died of complications from breast cancer. Andrea Mitchell is with us now. She is, of course, a longtime Washington journalist, host of Andrea Mitchell Reports on MSNBC, and she was also a longtime friend of Cokie Roberts. Andrea, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Andrea, Cokie's been remembered as a pioneer in broadcast journalism. You two were contemporaries. You both started at a time when there weren't that many women in broadcast news. Can you just describe a little bit about what it was like when you first started kind of encountering each other in the field?
Cokie was always such a mentor and such a friend, and it was so comforting to find someone who really understood Washington. I came from local news in Philadelphia, and when I came to the network, she was there. I can't even think of what it's like not to have her there as someone to look up to. She could be strong and tough when she needed to be. Don't get on the wrong side of her if you're misstating facts or not being straight, as John Tower, the failed nominee for defense secretary, discovered in 1989. But Cokie just knew how to do it so graciously and so intelligently. All of her reporting, always, and all of her interactions with people. And as often as there were problems and barriers, she overcame them, and she communicated such confidence that we could all get through to the other side and know that women would be at some point respected and valued as much as the men. But she was the standout among all of us because she was so smart and because she always, while having an inside track, never showed off or lorded it over anyone.
I wanted to ask you about that because the reality of it is she did kind of grow up walking the halls. I mean, both, it is that very rare experience where both of her parents had been members of Congress. And I wondered whether that helped her or in some ways did people resent it?
I don't know that anyone would ever resent Cokie because she was so gracious and lovely. So, yes, she had an advantage in knowing how things worked. And I assume that it gave her a better understanding of both the way things worked up on Capitol Hill, but also some of the challenges and some of the stresses upon members of Congress. And that perhaps made her more empathetic and better informed her coverage. I'm not sure it gave her a competitive advantage. Perhaps it did. But I don't think she ever crossed a line. Mm-hmm. When she had to be tough and when she had to be challenging, she was, whether or not these were people she had known since childhood.
One of the things that I think a lot of the young women I know appreciated about her is that she didn't feel that she had to hide her. She didn't have to act like one of the boys in order to be among the boys, if I can, you know, put it that way. I think sometimes I've heard many women in male-dominated professions say that, you know, they go through this phase where they kind of feel like they have to be one of the boys just to sort of survive. And I get the sense that she never kind of went through that phase. And I'm kind of wondering why you think that. I mean, including to the point of never hiding the fact that she had a family and these things were important to her.
No, absolutely. With her, it was automatic that her family came first. Her children, her husband, her faith. And she wasn't going to apologize for that. I think that was part of her strength, that she didn't feel she had to be tough and masculine, if you will, to compete because she knew her own strengths. Maybe it was going to an all-women's college and knowing how superior she was intellectually and how well-prepared she was for everything she did. Maybe it was that wonderful friendship with Linda Wertheimer and Nina Totenberg as the mothers of NPR and the founding mothers. But these wonderful women at NPR reinforced each other in their strengths. And they were not going to apologize for anything. And Cokie and her family You didn't even have the sense that she was struggling or juggling and trying to make these decisions, career or family. She knew where her heart was, and it was with the family. And she also did what she did, never whining or complaining. I mean, she was an effervescent spirit, a joy to be around, and also incredibly helpful to those of us who had breast cancer after she did, after her first occurrence in 2002. She had great advice for other people going through that and figuring out how to manage it, as she did with me and many others, I'm sure.
Hmm. How do you want to remember her?
I like to remember her as laughing and pushing back and never apologizing for herself on that Sunday show with Sam Donaldson. I certainly know what it was like to compete against Sam Donaldson from another network. I was at the White House for years and years with Sam Donaldson, you know, shouting on the other side of the Rose Garden. And she stood her ground with all those men, major figures like David Brinkley, when she first was a panelist on This Week, and then co-anchoring with Sam. She was an equal partner, if not a leading partner, regardless of gender. I just think of her as this wonderful, smart, effervescent personality with a great laugh, a great sense of humor, a sparkling wit, and a keen intellect, and irreplaceable. There just will be no one like Cokie Roberts ever.
That is Andrea Mitchell. She's host of Andrea Mitchell Reports on MSNBC. She's also the recipient of an Emmy Award for Lifetime Achievement. Andrea Mitchell, thank you so much for your recollections of our friend Cokie Roberts.
Thank you so much.
We've been hearing this hour from some of the people who loved and admired Cokie, those who were inspired by her work as a journalist and author, and who were energized by her drive and her kindness. This includes many of you who told us about growing up listening to Cokie's reliable and smart presence on this network. You've sent us letters and tweets sharing what she meant to you, and we're taking a moment now to share some of your words. Linnell Soliday from New Mexico writes this about Cokie. She made news reports understandable, contextual, relatable, and in doing so taught us and allowed us to think for ourselves, the most important aspect of imparting information and knowledge. I consider myself a broader, wiser, and more informed person due to my many years of listening to her through NPR. An American icon, indeed. Paul Taylor made note of the significance of the date she died, September 17th. Cokie Roberts has passed on Constitution Day. How appropriate a dedication to her. May our Constitution not pass with her. I and so many others will miss her wisdom and knowledge of our country's base. Here's what Jason Russell shared with us. I've never done this, but I quietly wept after hearing the news in my vehicle. Never have I had this reaction to the passing of a celebrity or anyone else in the public's eye. She was such a rock. I absolutely loved and craved her commentary, as it always cut through the political divides. It was straight, to the point, and simplified for us listeners that aren't always savvy with all the ins and outs of politics. Finally, Mary Rudy remembers Cokie Roberts this way. She has been one of my badass, wise woman heroes my whole life because of her scholarship and her moral and ethical standards that few have been able to equal. I haven't cried like this since Walter Cronkite died. Good night, Cokie Roberts. Please hold up that lamp for the women who follow in your footsteps. Thanks to all of you who sent us condolences and shared your memories. Now we have one from a colleague of hers from the early years of her career, when Cokie was a network reporter covering politics and other stories.
It was unusual for me to have a new best friend.
And yet, that's how it was for Linda Wertheimer when Cokie Roberts joined NPR in 1977.
And what we did was we worked together for decades, you know, in the sort of I could talk or she could talk. I knew what she was going to say. She knew what I would say. It was just a partnership as well as a friendship. Her parents were both in politics. I mean, she came out of politics. And I would say that, I would say in my own, you know, in praise of myself, that I would have every reason to be ferociously jealous because I had been working so hard to learn about the Congress and how it worked the way it did and get to know people. And Cokie walked in, and it was just like breathing for her. She had no problems with any of that. And apart from her enormous experience and the fact that she knew everybody, especially she knew all the little old men, you know, in the House, and she knew the head waiter in the Senate dining room. She knew that all helped tremendously. But she had a great liking for politics. That's the thing that I've always appreciated about her. Her take on politics was that it was so important, and we should pay such attention to it, and we should understand exactly why things happened the way they did, because she appreciated what the Congress was doing.
The hearings have been about more than the sale of arms to Iran and the diversion of funds to the Contras.
She was incredibly generous with her time and with her knowledge, and she would help whenever she was asked to help.
On Saturday, we found out for the first time that people in the control room at Three Mile Island had been wearing gas masks, which means that the air must have been full of the radioactive stuff.
Well, Cokie went to Three Mile Island to cover the explosion of a nuclear reactor. We were all afraid of it. You know, things were falling out of the sky. Who knew what was there? Who knew what was in the air? And so NPR didn't want to send anybody there who might be pregnant or be about to get pregnant. And Cokie then volunteered. She said, I'm done with that. So off she went to Three Mile Island.
The real reason was that I could drive. NPR at the time was a driving impaired shop. Several of our correspondents had been raised in Manhattan and never learned to drive a car. Others, like Linda Wertheimer, didn't drive because she had had a bad accident when she was young. And none of us wanted Nina Totenberg to drive because her eyesight is so bad. So I could drive the 2+ hours to Harrisburg. So I was the designated driver reporter on the scene. No one really knew what was going on. There was a certain amount of obfuscation, of course, but the powers that were, for the most part, were really as ignorant as we all were. The governor especially felt that he wasn't getting good information, and he started demanding it. But it was hard to get at the truth. Everyone had an axe to grind, either as pro-nuclear power or anti-nuclear power. So finding a straight shooter was really tough. As a reporter, I found it difficult to get good information. For the people around the Three Mile Island plant, it was almost impossible. They were frustrated and frightened, not knowing what the long-term effects of the release radiation would be on them or on their children.
She always regretted it because it scared her, and she hated things that scared her. But she went, and she did it, and she came back, and she had a ceremonial burning of the blue poplin suit that she had worn while she was at Three Mile Island. The friendship, the gift for friendship that she had was tremendous. Those people who listen to her on the radio, though, will hear all of those things coming through. And I hope that, I hope that we'll maybe preserve some of that and, you know, and make it available to people. But I think a lot of people have been listening to her on the radio for years, who've watched her on television for years. They have a strong sense of who she was and what she did and what she did and how she did what she did. And I think that they'll miss her as much as I do.
NPR's Linda Wertheimer, who, along with Cokie Roberts, is known as one of NPR's founding mothers. Now we turn to another of Cokie's longtime colleagues, Sam Donaldson. From 1996 to 2002, they co-anchored ABC's Sunday morning news program, This Week. Cokie left the program after her breast cancer diagnosis. They were friends for years. Off-air, he called her
Cokester,
and, you know. And she called him Samster. And Sam Donaldson is with us now. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, Michelle, I'm delighted to be here. To be with Cokie as a co-anchor was a dream team. It's the kind of team that you don't always see because there are jealousies in our business. There are competitions and all that. I'd like to do the big interview. Well, no, I should do the big interview. That kind of thing. Didn't happen with Cokie. Didn't happen.
You were at the funeral. What was that experience like for you? What was it like being there?
It's a lovely service. And, you know, there's an old saying, speak no ill of the dead. And so when someone dies that you know and you could say good things about them, that's what you do. No one that I heard could have said anything bad about Cokie because there just wasn't anything to say.
You know, you talked on Morning Edition when we first learned that Cokie had died, and you called her tough as nails.
She was.
Which is, I think, maybe a surprise to people who think of her as being this kind of very gentle, polite spirit. But what was it about her interview style that made her tough as nails?
Well, she's tough as nails, but very gentle. Make that combination. Few, if any of us, certainly I wasn't able to achieve it. Toughness to me was getting right in there and boring right in there and why don't you answer the question and all of that. Cokie's toughness came from a penetrating line of questioning put so politely and so docilely that the poor guy or gal, usually a politician, who was being skewered, didn't realize it till they dropped dead in the sense of not being able to answer a question they should have known the answer to. And could I give you a couple of examples?
I wish you would. Yeah, that'd be great.
In 1989, John Tower, a senator from Texas, had been nominated to be Secretary of Defense. But a lot of people on Capitol Hill didn't like him and started the idea that he drank too much. So he came to our program, and he immediately started by saying, I pledge that if I'm confirmed, I will never touch a drop of spirits alcohol as long as I'm in the post. Well, we thought that was wonderful. And I said, well, Senator, they also say that you're a womanizer. He said, Sam, what's a womanizer? Cokie Roberts spoke up. She said, Senator, I know one when I see one.
You obviously have very different styles on the air.
Oh, yeah.
I think anyone can see. But how do you think why do you think the chemistry between you was so good, even though you had very different styles?
I think, and I can't speak for Cokie, but I think we respected each other. I think from the beginning, we both said the other person is here for a reason. They've done it. They made it. They know what they're talking about. If you were paired with someone who really doesn't know the territory, you now can't do it as well as when you have someone like Cokie, who you don't have to teach her anything. And so we have a team there that empowers each other. And if I make a little mistake, she doesn't gloat over it. She doesn't say under her breath, well, of course, Sam wouldn't know that, would he? No, she would empower me to be okay about it. And I did the same thing for her on occasions.
So you really enjoyed working with her.
I
did. People could see that. Tell me more about that. Like, why is that? Why was the chemistry between you, it seemed very easy?
Well, to know Cokie, of course, was to love her because of the kind of person she was. Yes, I think we were right this past week to talk about how skillful a reporter she was, how she knew Washington upside down, because she says, I was born in the Capitol, certainly, with her family. But if you knew her, you learned how giving she was, what a fine person, how high morals she had, how she helped women. Because as you point out, when I got to the business, there were very few women. And so Cokie was one of the real pioneers as more and more women had the chance to enter our business. But they had to start in a ground floor level or they had to come without the experience and they couldn't cut it because not because they were dumb. They weren't dumb, but they just hadn't paid the dues in the trenches. Well, Cokie would help them up. Come with me, sister. Let me show you how to do it. Let me get a job for you. After that, you have to make it on your own, but I'm going to help.
A lot of reporters come to reporting because they're outsiders.
She
was the consummate insider, and I'm going to ask you how she navigated that, both being an insider, but also having the kind of the critical detachment that people expect from professionals.
She was an insider and knew it. She knew who she was and where she came from and what she knew and what her family represented in this town and all of that. But she never acted snooty. Instead, she helped the outsiders, particularly people who needed help. And I'm not just talking about people looking for a job in our business. I'm talking about people in the country. She felt for people who were disadvantaged economically. For instance, Cokie Roberts was from Louisiana, from New Orleans. I can almost hear her lilt right now, from a family in the Democratic Party. And she was for civil rights before the rest of us knew there was a problem there. And she was always something that you could count on for all of what I think are the right things, the progressive things, to help other people in this country who didn't make a lot of money, who didn't come from wealthy or well-known families.
The world is different than when you and Cokie started out. I mean, the political environment is different, but is there something that of Cokie's that you hope will endure even as sort of the techniques of doing the job have changed?
I think there are standards in life, there are standards in business, and we know what they are. You and I know what it is to be reporters. We know we have to try to find facts and bring them to an audience. And Cokie, of course, did that. But I think what we know and remember about Cokie is the standards in life that she represented. Whether you're talking about the golden rule, whether you're talking about helping each other as neighbors, as citizens, she wanted to do that. It was not about Cokie to Cokie. It was about us.
How are you going to remember her?
Oh, so fondly that I don't. I remember Cokie on this week as someone's broken my heart. Not your fault, darling, that you're so much of a person to be remembered and loved that when you passed, it breaks your heart. Not your fault.
Sam Donaldson, longtime journalist for ABC News, friend and co-anchor of Cokie Roberts. Sam Donaldson, thank you so much for talking to us.
Well, I'm pleased, Michelle, that you asked me to talk about Cokie because she was such a wonderful woman and a wonderful reporter and wonderful person.
Cokie Roberts was a prominent and public Catholic. NPR's Don Gagne has this profile of how her faith was intertwined with her life.
Cokie Roberts was never reluctant to talk about her religion. Her devotion to her Roman Catholic faith was deep and lifelong.
I am Catholic like I breathe.
That was on C-SPAN. This is from NPR's Talk of the Nation program with Neil Conan.
You, on the other hand, were raised Catholic.
And very Catholic.
Raised, to some degree, by the nuns.
Absolutely. And I still am in very close contact with the nuns who raised me and their successors. Great, great women, but also a very Catholic family.
Her father was former House Majority Leader Hale Boggs. Her mother, Lindy Boggs, was elected to her husband's Louisiana congressional seat after his death in 1972. Cokie attended Catholic elementary school in New Orleans and Catholic high school in D.C.
Give glory to his son.
In 1979, working for NPR, she covered the first U.S. visit of a new pope, John Paul II.
Cokie Roberts is on the Boston Common right now and has this report.
This is NPR's coverage 40 years ago next month.
And it is pouring rain, but people still waited. When the Pope walked in, the Purcell's trumpet voluntary played, and the crowd cheered and waved papal flags.
Cokie brought her journalistic skills and her knowledge of Catholicism to such reporting. Her books often focused on the role of women in American history. So, too, did her personal thoughts on the church. This is from C-SPAN.
Now, does it make me furious, the patriarchy of the church? Absolutely. And it makes me particularly furious on behalf of religious women, because there they are doing this incredible work. I'm talking about nuns really doing the work of Jesus.
In 2002 on NPR, she addressed the ordination of women as priests. She said she didn't think it would happen in her lifetime. But on that and on the celibacy of priests, she said of the Catholic leadership,
I think they understand that they need to do something.
And she bluntly labeled the church's sexual abuse scandals a truly shocking crime. Still, by Cokie's own telling, her faith never wavered. The Roberts marriage was one of mixed faiths. Her husband, Steve Roberts, whom she started dating in college, is Jewish.
I've often kidded that I'm the only Jew from Bayonne, New Jersey, whose mother-in-law was an ambassador to the Vatican. But now,
which brings us again to Cokie's mother, Lindy Boggs, who in 1997 was named U.S. ambassador to the Vatican by President Bill Clinton. This is from Boggs's swearing-in at the White House. It could almost be Cokie talking.
I want everyone to know that the Bible from which I took my oath was given to me by the Sisters of St. Joseph, who prepared me more for this job than any other group I know.
At the beginning of this story, we heard Cokie reporting on the papal visit of John Paul II. 26 years later, she was part of NPR's coverage of the funeral of that same pope at the Vatican. She provided her usual political analysis.
It's no accident that in June of a very close election year, 2004, President Bush called on the Pope to have his picture taken with the Pope.
But her commentary that day was also personal, as she recalled attending Mass and meeting the aging pontiff with her husband and her mother at the Pope's summer retreat.
And we walked into this tiny chapel and saw the sun shining on the aged Pope kneeling on a pregia, a kneeler in front of the altar. And we gasped because we felt we were in the presence of holiness.
Cokie Roberts on meeting the Pope and on her Catholicism. Don Gagne, NPR News.
We've been hearing from our NPR colleagues, from Cokie's ABC colleagues, and from you about her life and what she meant to everyone. We wanted to take a moment now to hear Cokie's own words.
A woman's place is something I've been puzzling about most of my adult life.
This is from the final chapter of the revised and expanded edition of her best-selling 1998 book, We Are Our Mother's Daughters.
It surprised me when I unearthed a journal where I occasionally jotted down my thoughts while we were living in Greece, to find something I had written when I was 33 years old and contemplating our family's next move. No one writes about women like me, and we probably form a large group who daily make the choice about our career, family, etc. It's not a one-time decision, but a continual one, and we can get so trapped by any alternative, the pure kid, pure work, or balance. So can a man, of course, but in nothing like the same way. The balancing act is one we must constantly recalibrate. What works one year doesn't work the next. What works for one child doesn't work for another. When you think you've cleared the decks for a project on the job, something happens in the family. Just when you've put aside time to be with your kids or your mother, something happens at work. It's foolish to make too many plans. Life gets in the way. Look, I know I've been lucky. I've been blessed with a happy marriage, 4 fabulous kids and kids-in-law, 6 healthy grandchildren, 2 long-lived mothers, the many joys of family and friendship, and a fine, fulfilling career. By living on this earth long enough, I've learned that clichés are clichés because they are true. It's true that you'll only have one opportunity to witness your baby's first step, to hold your dying sister's hand, to see your mother credentialed by the Pope, to hold your mother-in-law as she learns of her husband's death, to have your son introduce you to your first grandchild, to celebrate more than 40 years with your husband. There will always be another job. So what is a woman's place? For most women, it's many places, different places at different times. For almost all women, it's the place of nurturer, whether for the planet or one small creature on it. We've learned it from our mothers, both in word and deed. We teach it to our daughters in the knowledge that they must carry on the culture and care for it. Even as they go forward in this new millennium, knowing things we never knew, they will be connected back to those women in Marathon, Greece. From that continuity, they will derive the strength to make their place wherever they think it should be.
Cokie Roberts, reading from her book, We Are Our Mother's Daughters. We are remembering Cokie Roberts as a trusted voice in news, as a colleague, and as a friend. NPR's Nina Totenberg knew her as all three.
The country has lost a great journalist, but I and so many thousands of others have lost a great friend. Yes, thousands of others. Cokie was the embodiment of our better angels, whether it was her work for Save the Children or the millions of kindnesses, large and small, that she dispensed daily without ever thinking that what she was doing was unusual or remarkable. The country knew her as this always polite political reporter, willing to ask the impolitic question if necessary, this funny, wise, smart woman who could write circles around most reporters. For the last 3 years, as she battled the return of a cancer vanquished some 14 years earlier, she carried on, She gave speeches, appeared on TV and radio, and even was planning to go to Houston for the debates until her disease finally trumped her grit. She didn't want people to know she was sick. She loved life, and she was determined to live it as long as she could. And that meant doing what she always did, including being a super wife, mother, and grandmother. To know Cokie was to see the personification of human decency. There's a reason she was asked to speak at so many funerals. People felt such a deep connection to her because she touched their lives. Casual friends would find Cokie visiting them in the hospital. People in terrible financial straits would find her bailing them out, hiring them for work that perhaps she didn't need, but work that left them with their dignity. And I? Well, I'm not sure how I would have survived the long illness and death of my first husband without Cokie. She went with me to doctor's meetings, took notes, gave people hell if promised services were not delivered. And if, on occasion, she heard my voice faltering on the phone, she would magically appear to bolster my spirits. On a larger scale, she was always the voice of people with less power and the voice of what's right. I remember one day, many years ago, when we were in negotiations with NPR management over a labor contract. Management didn't want to extend health coverage to one group, and we were at an impasse. Then Cokie, who was working on a piece of embroidery, looked up at the management team and said, "You know, the position you're taking isn't immoral. It's simply amoral." The room got very quiet, and soon the impasse was over. And, of course, she was the voice of women. She understood injustices, large and small. She understood the hurdles that blue, pink, and white-collar women face in raising and providing for a family, in dealing with husbands and bosses. She understood the whole balance of life. I went to see her last night in the hospital. I'm not sure that she could hear me. But when I said goodbye, I told her I'd see her on the other side, at that big broadcasting studio somewhere, and that I knew she would still be a star.
NPR's Nina Totenberg. We've heard a lot this hour about all the things Cokie Roberts was during her career, about the relationship she had with colleagues, about what she meant to you. Now it's time to hear about the other very important part of Cokie's life, her life with her family. Joining me now is Stephen Roberts, a university professor now and also a distinguished journalist in his own right. He married Cokie in 1966. Steve, it's, I don't know what to say. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, Michelle, the outpouring of affection and respect for Cokie has just been overwhelming, and including a lot of folks who spent their lives listening to NPR. She was such a part of people's lives. You know, so many people grew up being strapped into the back seats of automobiles as their mothers tooled around town and were forced to listen to Cokie and grew up with that voice and grew up with that laugh. And so people have remembered it and talked about it so admiringly and so warmly. It's been very touching.
You've said, I think, repeatedly over the years that marrying the right person is the single most important decision you'll ever make in your life. What was it about Cokie that made you think this is the one?
You know, I met her very young. I was 19 and she was 18. And of course, she was very beautiful and had that wonderful laugh. But there was also such a keen mind there. You know, in that era, in the early 60s, in many ways, men were not expected to meet women who were their equals or even their superiors. There was a sense that, of a different kind of relationship. And I knew immediately that I had found a partner, Michelle. I had found an equal. I had found someone who could meet me and inspire me and excite me and talk to me and take care of me and in every possible way. Now, it did take me 4 years to get around to asking her to marry me because I was a typical guy and I was petrified of commitment. And as Cokie always used to joke, the way I proposed was to say, "Oh, all right, Cokie." But the fact is, it was by
romantic.
Far. Yeah, I thought it was pretty romantic. She didn't quite share that feeling. But I can tell you that it was the best thing I ever did in my life. And that's why I tell students, you know, there's always another fellowship. There's always another job. There's always another grad school. There might not always be another life partner. And given the fact that Cokie and I have lived the lives we had, that advice coming from us meant a lot to people.
And I hope it's one of the ways she'll be remembered.
And again, speaking of your decision to marry a person who would be an equal partner, you both had demanding careers in journalism. I want to remind people, you've been a professor, a college professor for a long time, but you also reported for the New York Times for more than 25 years. And again, you know, Cokie also had her career, which we know, and you're both raising two kids who, and now you've got grandkids. And how did that play out at home? I mean, did you know, some people who are both in the same field find it hard to navigate that.
Look, I would not, I'd be the last person to pretend, Michelle, that we were equals from the beginning in the sense of how the world viewed us and how our careers played out. Because you get married in 1966, the blunt fact was that we moved four times for my job. And my job as a New York Times reporter was always considered first. That was the way of the world in the 60s and early 70s. And it really was not until we came back to Washington in 1977, we'd been married 11 years, and Cokie got hired by National Public Radio. And I remember a moment, not long after she was hired, and she was sent to cover the disaster at Three Mile Island, the meltdown of the nuclear power plant there. And a few hours later, the New York Times tried to send me to cover that same disaster. And I said, no. I said, we have two children at home. It's not fair to have both of us in a danger zone. And that, Michelle, was the first moment that her career took precedence over mine. And that was 11 years into our marriage. So I don't want to pretend it was all perfect from the beginning. But at the same time, the one thing that neither one of us could ever say to each other, particularly, you know, the guy, you know, dear, you just don't understand. Right, hotshot. What exactly is it I don't understand about your life? So in the end, I think being in the same field was a far greater source of strength because we had that basic respect and that basic understanding about what each of us was going through.
One of the things that she helped me with was that I like having company, and the person I'm married to doesn't always. Just to put it like that, she shared, if it's okay, that sometimes you all had a slight difference of opinion about how many people you would like to have over at any given time. I remember that I believe that there were like 1,000 people at your wedding, if I have it correct.
You do not.
No?
There were 1,500 people.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry.
Look, she grew up in a public household. Both of her parents, not at the same time, but successively, were members of Congress and represented the city of New Orleans for almost 50 years. And it took me time to adjust to a public life. I grew up in a very small, private, immigrant world. And so adjusting to this big, boisterous, noisy, y'all-come world of the Boggs family and a public life, Cokie was certainly right. It took some time.
What would you want us to think about when we think about Cokie?
On the last day, I was able to talk to Cokie. Toward the end of the day, I'd been in her hospital room almost all day. And there was a nurse who she had become friendly with immediately, a woman named Judith. Judith had two small children and was pregnant with a third. And Cokie all day was bugging Judith. Judith, I want to see pictures of those children. Right? She said that to you, Michelle. How many times, right?
How many times?
And she finally came over, and these gorgeous kids, they're about 4 and 7. They had been at a wedding. The little boy had a bow tie. The girl was all dressed up. And Cokie's face, which had been drawn and stressed by her illness, just lit up with that Cokie smile. And she just said, Judith, what beautiful children. That was Cokie at her very essence. That smile, that kindness, that consideration, that's the image I will carry with me.
Stephen Roberts is a professor at George Washington University, which is here in Washington, D.C., longtime reporter at the New York Times, a columnist and author. married to Cokie Roberts since 1966. Steve Roberts, thank you so much for sharing her with us.
Thank you for asking, Michelle.
Finally today, I'd like to add my own few words to the many that have already been said about our friend and colleague Cokie Roberts. Of course, I was listening to and watching Cokie long before I got to know her as a colleague. For me, that was at ABC News, and then when I came to NPR. But I want to talk about Cokie because I want to confess I did not always appreciate her. Of course, I always respected her as a disciplined journalist, a lovely writer, a tough questioner, as a person who got the job done. But it took a while before I saw why so many people loved her, and it took a while before I did too. I had my reasons. I was young when I first met her, and I think that for me, as for a lot of young people, history began with what I saw in front of me. Hard to believe, I know. But by the time I got into the field, Cokie and her cohort of pioneers, Leslie Stahl, Judy Woodruff, Carol Simpson, Connie Chung, Barbara Walters, Ann Compton, and of course NPR's Nina and Linda and Susan, were already there. So while of course I had my own fights, and I still have my own fights, I didn't see their fights. I didn't see what it took for them to win basic respect. Also, I don't think I saw myself in her. Both of her parents had been members of Congress. She literally grew up walking the halls where I was just trying not to get lost. Her sister was a mayor, her brother a high-powered lawyer. It seemed like she had always been on the inside while I was still fighting to find an open door. But while I may not have seen myself in her, how lucky I am that she saw herself in me. I started to see this when I started to hit those cracks in the career sidewalk that seem to happen to all of us at some point, but especially those particular cracks reserved for women. In her own remembrance, our colleague Nina Totenberg talked about how when she was having a rough time, Cokie would magically appear. She called Cokie the embodiment of our better angels. I like to think of Cokie like Glinda the Good Witch from The Wizard of Oz, who would pretend to be setting you on the right path only to tell you you knew the way all along. Many times over the years when I was attacked for my reporting, a note would show up in my inbox out of the blue saying something like, "You were absolutely right to ask that question. You handled yourself perfectly." When Cokie and I were on the air together, in the green room or on the way to the studio, she would gently drop knowledge about everything from why she always walked to the studio instead of taking the elevator, to navigating a two-career marriage, to how to frame a sensitive question. Every so often, she would also be sure to drop some little tidbits about certain colleagues, especially, shall we say, certain celebrity male colleagues who had a tendency to treat other people, especially women, as if they were stupid or invisible. In essence, she would be saying, "They aren't all powerful. They are not 10 foot tall. Don't let them get to you." When I came here to NPR, the emails out of the blue continued. "Your show was so good. The mix was great. The interview with so-and-so was spot on. Thanks for making us all look good." And again, during the rough times, she would just show up. When the first show I hosted at NPR was canceled, she showed up in the office, although she had no reason to, just to take me to lunch in the cafeteria as a statement of solidarity. We had lunch just a few months ago. She emailed me, again out of the blue, just to see how I was doing. She let me pick the place this time, so I picked my favorite divey ramen spot. She liked it so much, she said she was going to tell her grandkids about it so they would think she was cool. Can I just tell you, I'm telling you all this just to say, we live in a time when we talk a lot about things like representation and allies and allyship, and those things are important, but Cokie also reminded me that those are new words for old things, like empathy and friendship and kindness. She reminded me that just because somebody doesn't look like you or talk like you or come from where you come from, it doesn't mean they can't understand your struggles or try really hard to do so and stand with you. I'm glad I got to see Cokie. I'm glad I got to know her. Mary, Martha, Corinne, Morrison, Claiborne, Boggs, Roberts, I appreciate you. This has been a remembrance of Cokie Roberts, who died September 17th at the age of 75 of complications from breast cancer. We will miss her so much. Thank you so much for being with us today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you're listening to NPR News.